You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week for Dear Science, we're joined by Dr. Kushla McGovern. How are we today?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Feeling good. It's a nice Tuesday morning that I did forget was a Tuesday in an interview this morning.
So oh, whoops.
We'll recover though. What have you got for us today for Dear Science? What has science got for us today?
Orca, bacteria, and fungi. So that's what's of interest this week.
My favorite things.
Yeah, orca. So are they cannibals or are they not? Kind of an interesting question to start off with. And this is one of these stories where it's really the headline catches your eye and then you start reading a bit more and you're like, okay, this science communicator did their job well because they hooked me in. So orca, we know them, killer whales. Turns out there's a lot of different types around the world. So we're in the North Pacific for this story where there's two types of orca that inhabit roughly the same area. There's what are called the resident orcas, very imaginative name, and Biggs orcas. And so the resident orcas, they tend to form these large family groups and they eat fish. Whereas these Biggs orcas, they are more common. They're a bit more transient though. They travel around a bit more. They have smaller groups and they actually hunt other mammals like whales and dolphins and seals. So these are probably the ones that if you've been checking out the Edinburgh documentaries, so you've been seeing footage of. Now it's been thought that these two kind of just avoid each other. They let each other do their own thing and they don't really interact. However, there's a paper that's just come out that indicates that maybe this isn't entirely true, but as you'll see, that maybe the evidence needs a bit more of a look at. So it starts in 2022. There was a Russian researcher who's just walking along the beach. He was working at the Pacific Institute of Geography in Russia, and he found this fin on the beach. And it had basically, it was all bloody and it was covered in tooth marks. And this isn't actually uncommon. Often you get minke whales or beard beak whales fins because they've been basically eaten by these Biggs orcas. What was interesting about this fin was that it was actually an orca fin. He didn't think too much of it, carried on until 2024 when he found another one. And he was like, okay, this is a bit weird. It would have been a bigger younger male or orca, but it had these same sort of tooth marks. And why you find the fins wash up on the beach is because they're not good eating. They're tough. They prevent the predator from actually eating all the muscle and blubber under it. So basically, they kind of try and get rid of them as quickly as possible to make it a nicer, easier meal. They did some genetic testing, and then you confirmed that both these fins were from these resident orca. And so from these teeth marks, they're thinking it's the Biggs orca that attacked them and then basically ate them. So this is where the cannibalism question comes in. And so what they kind of went from this was if you've got these Biggs orcas feeding on these resident orcas, maybe that's why the resident orcas also form these much larger groups, basically as protection to try and fend off these Biggs orcas. Now, this is what the paper's been published about, but what people have pointed out is that it is only two fins that they've found. What you could be is that, you know, these resident whales actually form these larger groups just because it's beneficial from foraging. Like if you've got more people looking for food, you're probably going to be more likely to find food. Also that they pass on their habitat and prey knowledge. So if you've got a larger group, that passing on knowledge is going to be much more efficient. And then, so that's from kind of the behavior aspect of forming these groups. But again, if we think about the fact that there's only two of these fins, it could also be just they were scavenged. So maybe resident orca died and then these big whales just took their opportunity and ate it. One of the authors of the paper did say that often when these whales do die out at sea, they will initially sink and then they float back up as they start to decompose and you get all the gases start forming. So they're like, a floating whale is not good eating. So that was their sort of reason for thinking why maybe that wasn't the case. And then the other thing was maybe it was just aggression. They had a fight, right? They got into it. And again, the authors of this paper said, well, we'd expect the marks to be on the side of the body, not around the fin, because you kind of think, if you think about the whale,
it's a weird angle.
It's a weird angle, yeah. Right? But that's not to discount it. So I don't think we should start calling the old Biggs whale a cannibal. You can also make the argument, is it cannibalism? They're all orcas, but they're different types, and gets into a whole species philosophy argument that we won't go into. But yeah, so this is basically, we've got these two fins, maybe it's suggesting something, but there's going to need to be a lot more observation of this before anyone's kind of confirming it.
And it's fun, more science though.
Yeah.
More science, yeah. In the future, what's the space? But yeah, what have we got next?
So bacteria to eat cancerous tumours from the inside out. This is really awesome. We're not going to see this anytime soon in the hospital. I'll just preface it there. But there's this group that have gone, bacteria are really good at eating and replicating. Let's use this to kill cancer, which is really cool. However, it does require genetically modifying the bacteria. They don't just do it by themselves. It's not a new species of bacteria that's been found. So they're using a species of bacteria that actually lives in soil. Clostridium sporogenes. Now, why they're using this is because it doesn't require oxygen. Now, if you think of a solid tumour, it's actually full of dead cells in the centre and there's no oxygen. So it's a really good environment for these bacteria because there's no oxygen and there's lots of nutrients. So if you put spores of this bacteria in the centre, they're going to go, this place is awesome. I'm going to eat. Yeah, I'm going to eat. I'm going to replicate. I'm going to eat. I'm going to replicate. And you're basically eating the tumour from the inside out. However, as you get closer to the edges of the tumour, there's a problem, right? We like oxygen. There's going to be oxygen. So we don't want the bacterium to stop eating, just getting close to the edges. So this is, starts to be where the genetic modification came in, right? So first they went to another species of bacteria, Clostridium aminovalicarium, which tolerates oxygen. Doesn't like oxygen, but it tolerates it. A little bit like, you know, some people in our lives kind of thing. And it basically, they took the genes that were to do with this oxygen tolerance and they've put them into this Clostridium sporogenes. And so they can survive longer on the outer edges of the tumour. They did this back in 2023. So this was kind of the first step. Okay, now we have this bacteria, it can eat from the inside out, gets to the edges, but now we've made it tolerant to oxygen, and we like oxygen, we have an oxygen sort of going all through our body. So now this bacteria can get out into our blood.
It's not going to stop. Right?
It's yeah. not going to stop. So we don't want to cure the cancer and then give ourselves a blood infection. Yeah. So we need to figure out some way of stopping them once they've done their job. And so what this is, what this paper is, this next step in this puzzle, where they've actually looked at what bacteria, a system that they already have called quorum sensing. So bacteria by themselves will grow, they'll produce some chemical signals, they multiply. As you get more and more multiply, your colony gets bigger, the amount of these chemical signals goes up, and it basically sends a message to the colony, like you need to produce more of this enzyme or you need to do something else. And so it's the way that bacteria communicate. Now, so what they've done here now is they've looked at another species of bacteria that does this thing called quorum sensing really well, Staphylococcus aureus, and which is a, yeah, so it's bacteria we know, right? Because this is one of the ones that's really important in terms of hospital infections and we have real issues with. So they've taken the basically the quorum sensing machinery of that and they've gone and put it into their bacterium that they're modifying, this Clostridium sporogenes, and they can basically, what they've seen is that they can make it produce the signaling compound. And that's the point they've got to so far. So now they know that they can get these bacteria to produce a signaling compound. So next step is to work out how to make the bacteria sense the signaling compound and go, right, stop, we've done our job. That's it.
Work's done, lads.
Yeah. So I did have to shout out to the writer of the IFL Science article who called it Hungry, Hungry Hippo, the Synthetic Biology Edition.
No, I do love a bit of bacteria. No, I don't love bacteria modification, but it is definitely one of those realms of, why not? Okay, yeah.
I mean, like from a... you know, so much of the medications and stuff that we get produced now from bacteria, right? Like it is, they are kind of really good at producing stuff.
It does feel like magic sometimes. I've just got to let it happen, and then we get stuff like this, and I'm like, yeah, awesome.
Yeah, look, I mean, to think, let's put bacteria into tumors and make them eat it from inside out. That, to me, is just absolutely fascinating to have, like, that thought process.
We do really like going, can something eat this? If yes, let's try that one. But yeah, well, thank you very much. What have we got next?
So the final story today is about fungi. So it's kind of, they are nice to eat, but this is not about eating the fungi we eat. This is about mycorrhizal fungi. So now let's see if I can say this properly. Have you heard of the wood wide web? Which is actually really hard to say because you want to say world wide web.
I do like it, but no, tell us about the wood wide web.
So this is this idea that trees and plants don't grow by themselves. They actually are in this symbiotic relationship with these mycorrhizal fungi that are throughout the soil. So these fungi act as extensions on the roots. So they basically grow further out and they can collect up nutrients and water and they take it back to the plant and they have this exchange. They give the nutrients and water to the plant and the trees and the fungi get some carbon from it. So it's this really brilliant symbiotic relationship. Now, we're as a society, we're interested in global warming and its effects because we know that we're heating the planet up a lot quicker. Like, the Earth has been hot in the past over geological time. We're just doing it very quickly kind of thing at the moment. So there's been this really interesting study going on at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab in Colorado, where for the last nearly three decades, they have just been warming some plots of land. They've just got out some heaters and they wanted to see if we warm this area, what's going to go on. And what they actually found is that the plants have shifted from being alpine grassland to more desert shrub land sort of plants. So a really obvious shift in the plants. But they've gone literally deeper into the soil and are looking at the fungi, because there was kind of this expectation that with the mycorrhizal fungi that they would kind of adjust to the temperature change, since it's over time and stuff, and, you know, like, they would just work it out or they'd bounce back. And actually that's maybe not what's happening or what does happen. So over this time period, what they've seen is the mycorrhizal fungi have decreased in the soil, but you've actually got an increase in what are called sopotrophic fungi. And these are the fungi that are the nature's recyclers. Mm. So these are the things that feed on the dead leaves and everything. This is kind of, it's a bit worrying because you've got consequences for this carbon and nutrient cycling, because basically your plants, if there's not this mycorrhizal fungi anymore in this big network, the plants aren't going to get the same amount of nutrition. They're not going to grow as big. And so now there's kind of like, oh, there's actually some vulnerable links in our ecosystem that we've probably never really considered in quite the same detail as plants themselves, in terms of how they're going to be affected by warmer winters and stuff. And one of the ways this kind of happens, though, is you get this warmer winter, the snow melts earlier, so your fungi grow, but they grow before the plants, and so they collect up all these nutrients, but they've got no one to give it to. And so then the nutrients just kind of leach out of the soil.
It just all collapses.
And then the plants don't get the nutrients and they just grow small. And yeah, so it's really quite interesting.
I imagine not good.
No, not good. Not good. So they are working on figuring out when is the decoupling point. Like, what is the kind of the tipping point where the fungi network and the plants end up out of sync? They also kind of want to investigate, you know, what if we migrate? So if we put some fungi back into the area, can we restore it? And there's a lot of efforts just in general around soil restoration in the world and stuff. So hopefully they can figure something out to fix it.
Hopefully. Yeah. Yes, I do. I love little soil fungus. Yeah. It's one of the joys of the natural world for me, just finding out, like, hey, they're just doing stuff.
Yeah, no.
Not to be reductive, obviously, to the role of fungi in ecosystems. But, yeah, well, thank you very much. Thank you for all of that. Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, MoTeT, and thank you, Science. STEM Fair is back again at MoTeT. Enjoy hands-on activities and demonstrations all weekend long from the 28th to the 29th of March.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTeT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.